Коррупция в нашей стране приобрела не просто
масштаб. Дачный кооператив «Озеро» был учрежден в 1996.
Питерский чиновник Владимир Путин когда-то был в числе его акционеров.
Кооператив «Озеро». Эти люди — Владимир Якунин, Андрей Фурсенко.
Его брат Сергей Фурсенко, руководитель Российского футбольного
союза. Я пахал как раб на галерах с утра до ночи.
На галерах владеет 26 дворцами. У него 5 яхт.
Before he built the Vertical, he built a team of like-minded cronies. Before he saved Russia from the chaos of the wild 90s, he manipulated that very chaos to advance his power and influence. And before he became the gatherer of the Russian lands, he gathered a fortune for himself in his inner circle. Before the Kremlin, before the oil boom, before Russia Incorporated, before the Georgia War and the Crimea annexation, there was the Ozero Dacha Cooperative, a group of influential St. Petersburg politicians and businessmen centered around the city's deputy mayor, Vladimir Putin. And if you were doing business in St. Petersburg in the 1990s, there was one ironclad rule. Putin was the man to know. But what does the Putin of two decades ago tell us about the man today? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me from Oxford, Ohio, is a special guest who can certainly shed some light on this question. Karen Dawisha is a director of the Habiger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of a soon-to-be-published book on Putin's St. Petersburg years. Welcome, Karen. Thanks for joining us. When I say soon-to-be-published, I hope that means sooner rather than later, because I'm dying to read your book.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
And joining us from Moscow via Skype is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
And joining us also via Skype from London is Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome back, Kirill.
Hello.
Karen, let's start with you. You've said in the past that Putin was the person to know in St. Petersburg, and as somebody who lived and worked in St. Petersburg in the 90s, I can certainly concur in that assessment. As chairman of the city's Committee for Foreign Economic Relations, he controlled thousands of licenses for the export of goods and the transfer of money abroad, and he did pretty well as a result of controlling those licenses. So flesh this out for our listeners a bit. How did Putin operate in the 90s, and what does that show us about the man today?
Well, he operated by gathering around himself a group of people, many of whom were former KGB, some of whom he knew from Dresden, some of whom he was trained with together in Moscow, the KGB school, the Red Banner School, and some of whom he knew from Leningrad KGB. So he had, of course, some connections in addition to that amongst liberal economists whom we all knew in the West, but he also had connections with other people and groups who were running money, and that includes organized crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we want to talk about that a bit going forward. What do you think, like, you've studied the Putin of this time period? Are there any hints about, like, clues to, you know, the man today? Was his behavior predictable? Was what he turned into predictable?
Well, the thing is that when we see, you yourself mentioned licenses, he was both the person who had to sign licenses for export of goods, but he also signed registrations of new companies. And so he was the linchpin of money going in and money going out. Western companies found him a very good partner because, you know, Procter & Gamble got their first license from Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. And from that, they've built a $6 billion per year business. So there are stories there that, you know, Western businesses, Russian U.S. Business Council would say that there have been success stories from that relationship. But there also have been businesses that Putin has been directly involved in, including having his name on the masthead, that have had a combo of both KGB friends, cronies in the business world and people who were subsequently identified by Spanish prosecutors as having mafia links. Mm-hmm. So it's a triangulation of groups that he was involved with. And the thing is that what's critical is that those contracts, say, let's say for export of goods abroad, had, and we have the contracts, between 30 and 50% commission. This is already in 1991, to be payable into the mayor's contingency fund. Where did all that money go?
Right, and Putin controlled that fund, correct?
Putin, well, I'm sure others had access to it, but of course, Putin was controlling the fund.
Now, Mark, I know your brief, I always introduce you as an expert in Russia's security services, but your brief's actually a bit broader than that. It includes spooks, crime, and corruption in my estimation. And we seem to have all three of these things here, do we not? In kind of a synergy among these three things.
Yeah, and in a way, I mean, that actually reflects Russia of the time, and to an extent Russia still today, is that these neat divisions that we draw between spooks and politicians and businessmen and gangsters and so forth actually aren't all that relevant, unfortunately, in Russia. That it's an established part of practice is that if you have a position, that of course you milk it. You find some way of, as the mafia would say, dipping your beak in whatever sort of income flows happen to be around. Just as if you're a mafioso, you also need to involve yourself in politics and so forth. I mean, I think what this speaks to, as much as anything else, is precisely the inchoate nature, the non-institutionalized nature of Russian rule of law. And I think it also, you know, all of this illustrates really the three key characteristics that Putin always, you know, back in the 1990s and still today, brought to his position. I mean, he's the decider, if I may use that term, who, you know, arbitrates decisions amongst other groups of people. He is the fixer who makes sure that things happen that ought to happen when it's in everyone's interest. And he is the protector of people within his circle, however he chooses to decide those. And those really have been the three enduring characteristics that come up in what Karen's been describing about St. Petersburg in the early 90s, and frankly still applies today.
So what's happened today? Is it just kind of I'm reluctant to use the term gone legit, but it's kind of become official. What was unofficial then has become official today? Would you put it that way?
Well, I mean, I think in some ways, you know, let's be blunt. I mean, even if you look at what was happening at the level of the presidency in those days when Putin was merely a fresh-faced deputy mayor, you know, it's clear that the levels of institutionalized and endemic corruption within the Yeltsin entourage were extensive. I think in some ways, it's more that the context has changed. The practice hasn't changed all that much, but because precisely Russia today looks that much less anarchic, it looks much more settled, and everyone is keen to present this consensual notion that, you know, actually Russia today is a normal country, we perhaps are more surprised or more struck by that. But really, you know, what we're talking about is something that A, predates post-Soviet Russia, and B, hasn't actually changed all that much in detail. I think what has changed is that precisely as it sort of has gotten sort of regularized over time, it's not done so much with overt threats and violence. It's that everyone knows the rules of the game. And 9 times out of 10, you know, you don't have to demand a bribe. A consideration is offered. But you don't have to come up with a bunch of, you know, carload of men with Kalashnikovs. One tax inspector or one fire inspector does the job. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that, again, it's a different idiom, shall we say, rather than anything else.
So the mafia state which operated in St. Petersburg has taken over the mafia state in Moscow. I was provoking you. But
exactly.
But I do want to pick your brain a little bit more, Mark, on your expertise on organized crime here, because anybody that was familiar with Petersburg in the 90s knows there was one group that was pretty much the dominant organized crime group in St. Petersburg in the 1990s, and that was the Tambovska Grupirovka, or the Tambov group. Can you tell us a little bit about the Tambov group, how they operated, what they were into, how they grew, and their connections to the authorities in the city at the time?
in many ways, the story of Tambovskaya is actually a microcosm of the story of Russian organized crime, full stop. I mean, it started, when it first started, and it, you know, again, predates the collapse of the Soviet Union by a few years in terms of its real roots, they were just thugs, criminals, protection racketeers, preying on the cooperative movements and so forth, these embryonic small-scale businesses that were emerging under Gorbachev. Then what happened is people got involved who thought, no, hang on a minute, this is actually going to be much more lucrative if it's handled much more in a business-like fashion. So they moved, as it were, up the food chain from shaking down sort of kiosk owners and shopkeepers into actually trying to sort of establish a strategic stake in what was then still Leningrad's businesses. With the collapse of the Soviet Union and the shift to a full market economy, everything was suddenly being privatized. Everything was up for grabs, and that's when they moved, particularly into the regional energy sector, but also into a variety of other commercial properties and such like. So increasingly what happened is you almost had two Tambovskayas, the thugs shaking people down and selling drugs and handling prostitution rackets on the streets, and a new elite, so-called avtoriteti, authorities, who were much more involved in politics and strategic level business. And the two maintained a sort of, you know, an uneven relationship, because clearly the businessmen were in charge, and as long as there's sort of enough money cascaded down to keep the thugs happy, everything was okay. But the problem was precisely that the avtoriteti, after a certain point, began to become politically problematic. They just become too powerful, too rich, and too well known for a regime that had started to worry about how it looked. And therefore, in due course, what happened was the state struck. Barsukov, the head of Tambovskaya, or the
Kumarin.
Kumarin also.
He has a lot of names.
Exactly.
He was known as Kumarin when I was in Petersburg. Around the time I left, he became Barsukov.
There you go. We will only assume it's a coincidence. Anyway, who was, as I think you pointed out in a previous podcast, known as the night governor. You know, yeah. He was essentially the sort of the shadow authority in the city.
Under successive administrations, I might add.
No, absolutely. I mean, this is a constant. It's like, you know, the same way as the business elite doesn't change. So, I mean, he was taken out. And what happened is Tambovskaya, I mean, on one level, it seemed to sort of actually fragment and sort of disappear. But actually what happened was that a lot of the avtoriteti, realizing that a new wind was blowing, simply took their ill-gotten gains and made sure they actually were much more kind of politically careful. They didn't move out of criminal activity, but they realized again who they had to pay off. They realized that in some ways it was much better to operate as a loose network rather than a clearly identifiable gang, and they frankly did perfectly well under the new status quo. So you had it morph, and in a way more of an interpenetration between organized crime and the business elite.
But Kumarin was sent to prison.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is always the thing. Sometimes you have to have an example. Sometimes you have to have a scapegoat that just simply says, look, you gangsters, as long as you realize that however strong your gang is, the biggest gang in town is the government. Mm. That's the key message. And therefore, as long as you work with the big gang, we're happy to basically franchise off areas, activities, and so forth to you. And this is really what happens. I mean, the state franchises out the opportunity to raise rents on all kinds of different businesses. But you appreciate that. And at any point you think you can challenge the state, that's when we will make an example of you.
So Vladimir Vladimirovich basically unified the five families, to put it in gangster movie mode, which I think I know Mark will have a problem with. I want to get go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, it's not so much he didn't unify them because you got lots of gangs. I think it's more that, you know, again, it's that situation where he brought them all to a table, metaphorically speaking, and just made them understand it was fine for them to carry on doing their thing as long as they realized that there was one greater authority than all of them.
Right. Now, I want to get to Kirill in a minute, but Karen, can you speak a little bit about Putin and Kumarov and Putin and the Tambovskaya Grupirovka a bit from your research?
I think you'd have to go back to the establishment of Bank Russia.
Mm-hmm.
There was, it depends a little bit which year you're talking about and which numbers of shares you're talking about, but let's say about one-fifth of Bank Russia's founding shares, between 15% and 20%, was controlled by Tambov.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. And of course, the other 80% was controlled by the founders of the Ozero Cooperative. So this group was connected from the very moment that Bank Russia was established, and I think that really explains why Bank Russia is the only economic unit that was found on the asset seizure list last week.
Yeah,
so that's one. They also came together in Putin's giving the license for exclusive monopolistic setting up of gas stations in St. Petersburg to the Barsukov-Kumarin gang, to Tambov. That's got his signature on it.
That's via the Petersburg Fuel Company, correct?
Exactly, through St. Petersburg Fuel Company. They also sat together on a public, their names are together on a German registered company, St. Petersburg, a real estate company called SPAG, that BND investigated it just as Putin was coming to power. And he didn't take his name off that masthead until after he was elected as president. So, you know, the West Germans came across this link when they were investigating Cali cartel money laundering, and that led them to SPAG. They weren't investigating SPAG per se. So we're talking about, you know, it's Tambov became a part of the international organized crime networks, and some of them, as Mark said, kind of went into quote-unquote legitimate business. But the key, I think, here is that in Chicago, they were suppressed by the federal government. In Russia, they were co-opted and allowed to continue business, provided that they recognized the regime as the ultimate Krisha.
Right.
That was the deal. Those gangs that didn't were suppressed. Those gangs that did were allowed to continue to have a very, very influential relationship.
And with Kumarin Barsukov, do you think, I mean, because I was a bit surprised when they came after him. Kirill, I remember you and I discussing this story in the old building here at RFE when you were working here. I was a bit surprised by this. Was he just, as Mark said, an example, or was he becoming a problem for Putin at the time? Either Mark or Karen or Kirill, anybody jump in on this. I'm not sure, because I don't know the answer to this. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I mean, I think, again, these things all roll together. You don't just pick an example just for the sake of it. It's precisely because he had just become too inconvenient, and because of all the places. I mean, this was in some ways Putin's soft underbelly, what had happened on his watch in St. Petersburg. And therefore, I think there was this desire to actually shore up the base, make sure there wasn't anyone who, metaphorically, if not literally, knew where the bodies were buried, who was out there. Make sure that it couldn't be said that, you know, his power base was really split between gangsters and the administration. And as I said, I mean, just the individual concerned, you know, he was regarded as actually having been a little bit too open, a little bit too arrogant in his relationships with the state, and therefore, for all these reasons, he then became a good example to pick.
No, he certainly was colorful. I worked in Petersburg in the 90s, and he was almost like Hollywood couldn't draw the Russian gangster stereotypically better than Kumarin.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Karen.
He'd been subject to an assassination attempt. He'd spent many months recovering in Germany. Perhaps there was some suspicion of the links that he established there, that he was seeking to come out from under, you know, the control that those in Petersburg were demanding. And, you know, you have at this time Malyshev, who was up and coming. And I think when the Spanish authorities arrested Gennady Petrov and others in Spain, you know, they termed them him as head of the Malyshev-Tambov group.
Right. Well, yeah, Malyshev was a faction within Tambov, yeah.
Right, so that there's changing names, but I don't think that we can say that the relationship ever ceased. And I think it's critical to remember that when that group was arrested, of course, none of them ended up in Spanish prisons, the prosecutor said that they had thousands of hours of tapes of these people talking with ministers, including the defense minister in Russia. Mm-hmm. So this relationship, which was established from the very beginning, became a governing mechanism for certain kinds of influence.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it ever went away.
Kirill, I want to bring you into the conversation because I know you have a lot to say about all this stuff.
So. I'm not very experienced in Kumarin-Barsukov relationships to Putin and so on, but I'd like to focus on one, in my opinion, very important side of the problem. It's the connection between close relationships between Russian liberals in 1990s and 2000s and KGB agents and Putin himself.
This is something I do want to, glad you brought that up.
It's very interesting because on the first glance, it's very strange because, you know, on the one side, KGB agents with all this background and so on the other side, you know, liberals with their attitude to, you know, market economy and especially democratic government and so on. But if we'll return to the context, political, especially ideological context of Russian 1990s, we'll see that there is no any, you know, surprise in this connection. Because just imagine the society is just, you know, just Soviet society where the authorities are trying to enforce, to introduce a market economy. Market economy is not something, say, natural. it's a sort of a very sophisticated system, not just as an economical system, but a way of thinking, a type of public opinion, consciousness, and so on. And if you want to introduce such things to, say, Soviet society and so on, you have to use some tools. And liberals, they thought that they can use all this old system of KGB and so on, the part of the system, mm-hmm. yes, of like, you know, as these tools. And that was a delusion, of course. And they used such people like Putin and a lot of some other people like tools, instruments to enforce market economy and some even, you know, democratic institutions to Russian society, to apply all these things to Russian society. And, of course, they needed, terribly needed, the help of such people like Putin and all these people from KGB to beat the insurgency in 1993, to win the presidential elections in 1996,
mm-hmm.
And so on. So this happy union of Russian liberals and former KGB and some other, you know, institutions from Soviet Union, people was very reasonable, logical, and it was still reasonable, logical, and natural in some sense, even in 2000s. And now what we see in the recent history of Russia, that is the dissolving or cracking of this union, because these two...
Or the KGB is now using the liberals to legitimize themselves.
Yes. So I was speaking from this from the point of view of liberals. But if we turn to the point of view of all these KGB people, we'll see that 1990s was the, you know, a sort of preparing period for obtaining their power in the country. And they used liberals who thought that they are using all these people.
This is a very important point that I think the Kirill raises, and I'd like Mark and Karen to both weigh in on this. Is like, do you think that this was thought out, that they played this, we will be your muscle for now, and then we will be the masters later? Or I know Mark, you're not crazy about conspiracy thinking, but what do you think?
Well, my view is exactly that it's not that there was some grand plan, that there was a conclave of KGB people in some extinct volcano somewhere who decided this is how we're going to sort of come back to power. It's more just the natural logic of the market. The new political market that basically obtained is that they had a variety of assets ranging from their kind of metaphorical little black books of contacts through to a certain sort of, you know, forcefulness and discipline of approach, through to, in many cases, access still to funds and informants and whatever else. they knew that at the moment they were relatively vulnerable, and therefore they had to be of use to what seemed to be the rising new elite of Russia. And therefore they leveraged what they had to become of use, and in the process actually largely outmaneuvered the sort of liberal class or whatever. But again, I mean, I wouldn't regard that as a sort of a plan. I would just regard it as a natural offshoot of just how this country went through this kind of rather bizarre and halting form of transition.
Mm-hmm. Karen?
I wouldn't disagree, but I would create certain kind of links between what Kirill and Marx have said now and what Marx said earlier, and that is, you know, this process started in the late 80s. So when you have it being legalized to establish cooperatives, and some of those cooperatives were given foreign export licenses. We know that in addition, after the wall fell in 89, there was a panic in the top regions of the KGB and the conservatives in the CPSU about how they were going to survive the potential of a multi-party system. They decided they needed to get money abroad because they didn't want to have the same problem happen to them as had happened to the Poles and the Hungarians, where the ruling party lost its connection with the state. So money started to flood out, and we have those documents. So those documents became available when the party was put on trial in 1991, after 1991. Kroll Associates was hired by Gaidar and Yeltsin to try to find this money, which was estimated wild differences in estimation, but in the billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So here you have the KGB. The KGB was very important in the cooperative movement. You know, it wasn't the dissidents or people like Marina Salier or the real liberals who were establishing cooperatives. It was, or who were being approved to establish cooperatives. It was KGB and Komsomol. I mean, we know about this. This is well documented. And so when the Soviet Union fell, you know, there were certain people who had a real head start. And, you know, if you believe in past dependency theories and political science, those who start the establishment of a system are the ones who are going to really have a big influence in that. So this group was in favor of privatization. No one denies that. But they also were from the beginning and have been in favor of controlling that privatization. They favor a Pinochet style of privatization. And I think I would add to what Kirill said in the sense of saying that this was widespread throughout Russia. This was not only happening in St. Petersburg, but St. Petersburg was the window for the flooding out of raw materials. They were leaving via the ports. So that it became a real hub for export. And, of course, a lot of Western companies looked to St. Petersburg to establish their first businesses. We shouldn't underestimate the importance of St. Petersburg in this story.
No, as somebody who works as a reporter in St. Petersburg in the 90s, I would say it's just really striking how much the Petersburg became Russia in a lot of ways. And my God, Petersburg in those days, it was colorful. I mean, you had gangsters with names like Kostya Mogila, oh, yeah. Right? Kostya the Grave, right? He controlled the graveyard mafia, yeah. And his name was Kostya the Grave, right? I mean, it was.
I met him several times.
Yeah. I never had the pleasure. I've seen him at a distance, though. But I also, before we move on to the next point, is something that Kirill raised about this nexus between the KGB and the liberals. I mean, the Subcheck-Putin alliance, the Anatoly Subcheck-Putin alliance kind of mm-hmm. encapsulates this. And to be honest, somebody who is, you know, we all make our mistakes. Putin, I looked at Putin as almost like a liberal in the 90s. Because if you looked at a lot of different political fights, he was on the what we would today call the liberal democratic side of those fights. And I mean, I remember when he was
in favor of privatization, right?
Yeah. But he also even he was, if you saw when the different clans were fighting for control of Petersburg and Korshakov and his people were trying to get ultimately successfully got Vladimir Yakovlev installed as governor or elected as governor. Right. Putin was obviously on the other side of that fight. So if you look at a lot of these battles, the battle over the city charter in 1998, Putin was on the side of what was a very democratic city charter at the time, but it was all tactical. It wasn't, there was nothing strategic about it. Mark, I see you have something to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say, I mean, I agree with you, but I think what that reflects is the extent to which just because people had a KGB card, we shouldn't assume that they were communists. Yes, of course, they had to be members of the Communist Party or whatever, but they didn't. You know, the days of the honourable Czechist, if there ever was one, but certainly the ideological Czechist, I think had long, long since gone. I mean, in many ways, Yuri Andropov was the last of them. I mean, actually, people had joined the KGB because that was how you rose. That was how you had a good life. That was how you might have a chance to travel abroad. All these kind of reasons. So in other words, they were already the arch-capitalists. They were there because that's how you basically were as near as you could get to be a capitalist within the Soviet system. And then, of course, they then sort of, you know, were the first to adapt. And whether it was in terms of, taking control of lots of these funds, and Karen's absolutely right about the extent to which the Communist Party was, you know, scared and was basically salting money away and resources. And it's worth mentioning that I think it's just 5 days after the failure of the August coup in 1991, Nikolai Kruchina, the treasurer in charge of all these sort of secret stay-behind funds, mysteriously leapt from a window, and with him all the accounts. So clearly
he fell from a window.
Exactly, as one does. So did his successor. But anyway, we shouldn't be surprised that actually a good KGB officer or even a mediocre KGB officer like Putin would therefore be on the side exactly of the free market and also on the side
though?
Of his own plan. Well, democracy, opposing Korzhakov and his designs is as much as anything else a factional thing. I mean, Korzhakov wanted to make St. Petersburg a fiefdom.
Right, but I guess what I would say is that the sides Putin lined up on were on the sides of people whose names are not – nobody knows these names now because these people are nowhere near politics anymore. But people like Alexander Shulkanov and Leonid Romankov and people who were true Democrats, just these people that got elected in the first wave.
But who were their enemies?
Their enemies were the other faction. But the thing is that Putin lined up behind these – what I would call, true Democrats, and this is why they're nowhere near politics these days. But it wasn't because it wasn't out of conviction; it was out of tactics. But he consistently lined up on that side.
No, because he knew how to become the ideal bagman. But anyway, I think I know Kirill has
something to say here. Yeah.
What we terribly need now, it's a serious, sociological research of the process in the end of 1980s, the beginning of 1990s, and the sources of various groups and elites, recent elites in Russia. Because as far as I understand, there were several sources of, political leaders and activists of that time. KGB, several groups inside KGB, of course, and of course, Leningrad KGB was absolutely different from the Moscow one, by the way.
Absolutely.
It was very harsh.
Yes, it was one of the harshest in the Soviet Union.
Yes, in comparison to Moscow people from KGB. And at the same time, they tried to play, liberal games. In the beginning of 1980s, they let rock musicians to organize a famous Leningrad rock club and so on. At the same time, don't underestimate the influence of some other groups. For instance, so-called Komsomolcy, it's Komsomol elite, which is different from KGB, of course. So don't underestimate the influence of some other groups, not just Komsomolcy, Komsomol elite, which is different from KGB, but even the mixture, people with mixed backgrounds, like graduates from Moscow Institute of International Relations, which were very strong in the press and in politics in the beginning of 1990s, and still are. For instance, the culture minister Medinsky is from this institute, and so on. So it was a mixture of several very influential groups, which were supported several wide public movements.
Right.
And we can't speak about, pure Democrats or pure, liberals or some pure conservatives at the time. So crystallization of the political system began just in the middle, in my opinion, in the middle of 2000s. Mm. And that's very important. So just You know, just remember the fate of Milonov, this, you know, infamous local MP.
Yeah, he fashioned himself as a liberal in the 90s. I knew him in the 90s. He was actually a pomoshnik of Galina Starovoitova in the 90s. I knew Vitaly quite well then. I said, this is a kid with a future. I didn't really imagine what kind of future he was going to end up having. One thing I want to get to before we move on to the next section, when we'll talk in more detail about Karen's book, is the Azero Dacha Cooperative itself and some of the key figures in this. And also, there was an interesting leak from the U.S. government today on corruption in Putin's inner circle. And I was wondering, Karen, if you could kind of walk us through both of those things. What was significant? Who were the key players in the Azero Dacha Cooperative, and where are they now? And also, what you pulled out of that interesting leak that from the U.S. government about corruption in Russia in Putin's circle?
Well, the Azero Dacha was established in 96. It was registered in 96. You know, we have anticompromat.org has the document online, so you can see the actual registration document. It brought Putin together with those people, mainly, we can say, who are now on the U.S. travel ban and asset seizure list, people like Shamalov, Yakunin, the railways ministers, Kovalchuk, Myachin, who was some of these people also were the ones who established Bank Russia. Mm-hmm. And it did two things. It brought them into physical contact in the sense that they established a gated community along a lake in northeast of St. Petersburg, but it also, using the laws of cooperatives, which had not yet been superseded by other laws, they established a cooperative bank account in the Leningrad Oblast Bank. The number of the account is 180-461-008. And this allowed people to put money into that, and anybody in that cooperative could withdraw it. Mm. I think that we can all see what the implication is.
Of course we can.
So when we see people over and over and over again from Boris Berezovsky on saying, you know, Putin never took a bribe, and that trope about Putin is kind of run up against the Ozero Cooperative, well, you see he didn't need to take $50 bills in an envelope. He had the Ozero Cooperative.
Right, right.
So this was a legal vehicle for sharing of funds, not just the physical space. In fact, much less important than the bank account was the physical space, because he's gone on, as we saw from the leaks yesterday from the U.S. government, to establish 20 residencies. He has 58 planes. He has 4 yachts. So he doesn't need this little lakeside so-called dacha, more like a cottage.
Right.
and this group... Why the 90s is important is because this group is stable, and they are still in power, and they still are rich. I mean, when Credit Suisse gave its report last year on the world's wealthy, Russia has the most stable environment for billionaires of any country in the world. Those people who were billionaires in 2000 are still the same people. There are more of them, but those people haven't lost their money. So when you think about capitalist systems, you think about risk and reward, you're willing to take more risk because the rewards are so high. There's no risk in Russia if you're close to Putin.
If you're close to that, and only if you're close to Putin.
Was established in the 90s.
Okay, anybody want to add anything before we move on to the next section? Okay, we'll just move on then. And in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and take a look at why we will have to wait a little bit longer than we would like to read Karen's book about Putin in the 1990s. And I'll give you a hint, it's not because she missed a deadline. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFARL. Joining me from Oxford, Ohio, is special guest Karen Doisha, director of the Havergar Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of a forthcoming, hopefully soon, book on Putin's years in St. Petersburg. And joining us from Moscow via Skype is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based History and Sociology Sociology Magazine, NZ. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Dear Karen, many apologies for the delay in getting back to you. I know that you understand that this is a difficult question, and I appreciate your great patience while we worked through the issues involved. After discussion with legal colleagues, who have reviewed the typescript from both a US and UK legal perspective, I'm afraid that our view is that we are not in a position to proceed with your book.
Okay, no fancy intro required here. Let's just cut to the chase. Anybody who follows Russia closely knows the Cambridge University Press has decided not to publish Karen's book due to fears of lawsuits from Putin and his cronies. Karen, to get the ball rolling, why don't you just walk us through this? Although I must imagine you've got to be tired of telling this story.
Well, it's a pretty simple story. I mean, since 1990, I've published 7 books with Cambridge. I have a long-standing relationship with them and a high respect for their worldwide reach and the quality of their publication. So naturally, when I was at a point where I had something to show them, this was in 2011, I submitted a prospectus and it was reviewed, and 3 reviewers were in favor of publication, 1 was against, and so on that basis, the editor said, let's proceed with the project, and when you have the manuscript, you know, let me know. So it was submitted to them in early November of last year, and with my full agreement, they decided to show it to their legal department first, and after 5 months, the legal department came back saying that they felt that there was no way that they could advise me about edits that would make them feel comfortable with the prospect that the book wouldn't be challenged in Britain's libelous environment. So that's the basic. So the manuscript never, the entire manuscript never went out to full review, which is, I think, disappointing because one would have imagined that at least they would have allowed the manuscript to be reviewed by other academics so that along with the views of the legal department, one could look at it and say, okay, well, if we proceed in this way, then there's a very good prospect that it could give, you know, be revised to give them comfort.
Mm. And you're looking for a U.S. publisher, is my understanding now, yeah?
Yeah, I think, you know, their advice was, I mean, they simply said that the climate in the United States is such that people who are in the public and evidence that's in the public, and this, my book is entirely right, based on public documents, really can't be challenged in court for libel.
Right.
And well, there are many precedents to this, by the way. There are many manuscripts that were, and I know of 6 now, that suffered this fate in the UK and were then published in the United
States. Well, I'd like to be the publisher because I bet this book's going to sell quite well. I think they've done you, at the end of the day, maybe a favor, and it's been boosting your sales. My first thought when I heard about this last week, and we had our Washington correspondent get on, it was, wow. I mean, we knew Putin could censor the Russian media, but now he's able to stop the world's oldest publishing house. We actually looked this up in the newsroom. The oldest publishing house, the venerable Cambridge University Press, which was founded under Henry VIII, from publishing an unflattering book about him without even saying a word. Kirill, you and I were talking off mic a few days ago, and you said you had a few things to say about this, so have at it.
First of all, I'm not sure that it's a story of enormous influence or some dirty tricks.
I don't think so either. Yes. Just the mere fact, yes, though, that
yes,
there's this fear.
It's all about the context and the atmosphere in the, modern Europe about all Russian things. First of all, of course, Russian government and Putin himself have a lot of ability to stop doing a lot of things because he can sue the publisher. He can, just open some smear campaign in the press and so on. And of course, the university publishing house, it's just beware of all this stuff. But another thought is not about this particular, I think, shameful situation, but about the attempts of Putin himself and his regime to make his public appearance much better and more appealing and so on. I think everyone knows that the Russian government spending, a lot of money to improve this PR image of the regime. But I never, ever, met such clumsy efforts like this campaign. For instance, who's remembering now about the opening ceremony of Olympic Games, which, was a... most important thing in Russian, politics for several months. Yes, and especially to show the all, to show the world how, wonderful, how modern, how rich in cultural and some other aspects is Russia. But no one is remembering till now, what was happening the very first day of Olympic Games because of the Ukraine crisis and so on. So that is a very important example of how all this money, are spending for such absolutely useless things. Because, of course, you can hire some PR company which will, improve for several days your public image and so on. But if you are acting like Putin's regime is acting, for instance, just now, so no any other there is no any PR agencies who can improve the public image of such a regime
or even lawsuits.
Mark,
I want to go to you because also you write about similar topics. In fact, to put it in your own words, you probably know more about Russian criminals than is good for your health. Have you ever run into anything like this, like what Karen's run into? And what do you think it portends?
Well, I mean, yes, one encounters it all the time if you're writing about crime and corruption and so forth, because particularly there's this basic issue that unless something has been proven in a court of law, lawyers are not comfortable with you saying it. And given if you're talking about a country like Russia, a lot of these things that everyone knows happens and is reported as fact, but nonetheless is never going to be tested in a court. That's the nature of things. So you have to find ways around it and so forth. And I confess, when some gangster dies, part of me thinks, thank God, I can now actually name this person. But I would say that in terms of the libel law, I mean, this is simply a reflection of the fact that Britain has the most ghastly libel laws imaginable that are good for no one except ill-doers and lawyers. And of course, I would want to stress that I hold lawyers in the highest esteem and will not want to suggest that the two are one and the same. But I think this is something that we've encountered in so many other contexts. Without in any way wanting to minimize it, if this had been a book about, say, corrupt Nigerian politicians, if ever there were such, then the lawyers would have exactly the same qualms. Because nowadays, unfortunately, the kind of elites that we're talking about often are globalized elites who are willing and able to basically carry out libel tourism, come to the UK because they're basically the burden of proof goes on to the writer. I mean, it's about the one sort of legal situation in which you are basically guilty until you can prove yourself innocent, and that's the way it is. So, anyway, unfortunately, publishers, particularly British publishers, always have to do this. But in some ways, I mean, I would say that what it does do, and here I'm sort of riffing in some ways off a point that Kirill made, is that it does also bring to mind that the whole array of different and often very negative tools that Putin, the Kremlin, the Russian regime use precisely to try and influence perspectives of them. Obviously, ideally, they'd like to have people say nice things. But if all else fails, they want to try and drown out the things that aren't. So we have everything from not just, you know, public relations firms, but also all kinds of internet trolls and shills, of which, you know, the Power Vertical's webpage is not entirely
they love my webpage.
Untouched by this issue. We have, for example, business interests, Western business interests that want to be able to do business with Russia and therefore find it in their interest to try and put the most positive gloss possible, and certainly to try and sort of impede issues like sort of potential sanctions or whatever. We have social conservatives. We have this case of, you know, Pat Buchanan, who in Putin choose to see something that they like. And then we have the sort of the ragbag collection of contrarians, tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theorists and the like, who basically are happy about anything that challenges their own mainstream media. So the point is, I mean, one thing that the Kremlin is quite good at, and although it's a terribly, terribly negative thing, but precisely is encouraging, funneling, and giving airtime to these people to try and throw static, you might say, on into the information space, mm-hmm. to try and get in the way of real knowledge, real truth about what's going on in Russia coming out. And in that respect, yeah, it's not as good as having everyone say wonderful things about Russia, but at least it's, you know, in these circumstances, it's the best tool mm-hmm. Russia's got.
Have you ever had to water down a manuscript, or have you ever had a manuscript squashed because of concerns like this?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I've had things bounce back to me saying the lawyer's unhappy with this, this, and this. You know, because there is this sort of fond assumption that, I mean, there's this sort of belief that, oh, well, if you put allegedly down, that doesn't cut it. you know, you can't just simply say, oh, well, I found a newspaper article that says so-and-so happens. You know, that you are still basically putting your own weight, and so is your publisher putting their own weight behind it. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a very, very delicate art of actually trying to balance that. And the trouble with particularly the kind of high-level stuff that Karen's writing about, and obviously I haven't seen the manuscript, but it is exactly, you are dealing with people whom you know full well, many of them have got carnivorous lawyers at their disposal.
Right.
And, you know, even if nine things you say is are true, if there's that one thing that you say that is false, that's the one that they're going to go after.
Well, I will say the one time in my journalism career when I spent more time talking to the lawyer than I did talking to an editor was when I did a story about this very topic, but for Newsweek International back in 2000, actually, about Putin and St. Petersburg and the whole. Capital of crime meme that was going around at that time. One thing I did want to clarify is that with libel shopping the way it is today, does going to a U.S. publisher get around being able to be sued in the British courts? Presumably this book will be available in the U.K., right? This is something I'm not clear on. Go ahead, Karen.
I've become knowledgeable about this. And as a result of a book about a completely separate subject, without going into the details, was published and then pulped by CUP, called Alms for Jihad, the state of New York and then the U.S. Congress passed a law that said no U.S. author can be sued for libel in any jurisdiction that does not offer the same protections as the U.S. So this is a pretty bright spark, and I think that it has given all of those manuscripts that, I mean, as I say, I now know of six of them that have withdrawn to the protection of U.S. publication coverage.
So it's a boon for the U.S. publishing industry, then, I guess. I mean, because it'll drive the most interesting manuscripts to U.S. publishers. Karen, I joked about it earlier, but do you feel that this has increased interest in your book and is actually going to be a blessing in disguise, a free advertisement? Do you get that sense?
Well, judging by the interest that I've, you know, seen in terms of people being in touch with me and retweeting and, you know, putting things on Facebook, it suggests that a lot of people are very interested in the story. And a lot of people actually are pretty knowledgeable about the story. So putting it, I think, together in one space, it will be very useful. You know, I would say that it is the one thing that is really, to me, most sad about this story is that a lot of Russian journalists have tried to write about this story since Putin came to power, and it's been, become increasingly difficult for them and dangerous for them. And a lot of Russian journalists published this story in the 1990s. So it is sad that those journalists' efforts should meet up with the fear of a British publisher. I think it's a really, that aspect to me really, it really saddens me.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it'll all be, your book will be out there soon and it'll all be vindicated. Do you have a working title right now? I was looking around to find the title. What is it? Or do you have one?
Well, it's a long title. It's currently called The Origins of Putin's Corrupt Regime, How, When, and Why Putin Established the Regime, and What is Its Future.
Oh. Well,
it'll change, I'm sure, in the process of, you know, moving towards a final, but that's its current title.
And how goes the search for a U.S. publisher?
You know, I'm sending it out, and we'll see what the responses are. So, I mean, all of this is rather... This is less than a month old, so these things take a little bit of time.
Yeah. All right, before we wrap up, Mark Kirill, do you have anything you want to ask Karen about this? I want to give you the chance to ask some questions as well, if you want to.
From my point of view, it's a very symbolic story about the publication of the book, because it shows how Putin's regime used democratic traditional for West institutions as a tools. We are returning to the topic of from the very beginning of our podcast, who is using who and who is using what particular things. Because for Western society, such institutions like courts, legal process, like, you know, the laws about the press and media and so on, they're, you know, almost sacred. And this is a product, a result of a very long history of a Western society. And for Putin and for his aides, it's just a tools to achieve their aims, and that's all. And that's why, in a sort of short perspective, in, you know, tactic, in pragmatic things, they can win, you know, a battle, but they cannot win a company. Because, of course, institutions, especially democratic and Western institutions, they are stronger than the pragmatic attitude of even the authoritarian regimes in such big countries like Russia.
Let's hope. Mark, what did you...
I just had one very quick question for you, Karen. I mean, something that I've been very curious about is the Ozera Cooperative. I mean, have you identified, you know, it was one person the catalyst who actually brought them all together? I mean, I this is what I'm always curious about, is actually how this group found themselves in this particular format.
Different people take credit for that. Smirnov was very influential. He's the lead name on the document, and he's listed as the rukovoditel. So I wouldn't imagine that would be untrue. But Shamalov also has been named as somebody who was very influential. Shamalov, we may remember, is the point person behind Putin's palace, and was the representative for Siemens in the Northwest Territories and federal units in the 1990s, actually, until Siemens was taken to court in the United States under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, he was their representative.
Oh.
So there's definitely, I would say, those are the two main people. But Yakunin's very proud of that relationship, and there's nobody who would not stand by their participation.
Oh, no. Too much of a money pit, that
right, is. Yeah. Well, Karen,
absolutely.
When this is finally published, I hope to have you on again if you're willing to discuss it at greater length and when we've all had a chance
to
read it. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RVRL. Joining me from Oxford, Ohio, has been special guest Karen DeWisha. Director of the Habiger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of a forthcoming book on Putin's Petersburg years. Also joining us from Moscow via Skype has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from London has been co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Thanks to all for a fascinating and enlightening discussion.
My pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant and very overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper who will be playing Prague this weekend. That's Noise MC.